Blackstone Audio presents A Winter Haunting by Dan Simmons. This book is read by Bronson Pinchot. This is for Karen. For he was speechless, ghastly, wan, like him of whom the story ran, who spoke the spectre hound in man. Sir Walter Scott, The Lay of the Last Minstrel, Canto 6, verse 26. The hounds of winter, they harry me down. Sting, the hounds of winter. 1. 41 years after I died, my friend Dale returned to the farm where I was murdered. It was a very bad winter. I know what you're thinking. There's the old journalism anecdote of William Randolph Hearst needing someone to cover the Johnstown flood and sending a young cub reporter. It was the kid's big break. The next day, the novice cabled back this lead to Hearst's paper. God sat on a lonely hill above Johnstown today, looking down in sorrow at nature's fierce destruction. Old-timers swear that Hearst did not hesitate 10 seconds before cabling back this response. Forget flood story, interview God. I say I died 41 years ago, and your response is, forget the story about Dale, who cares? Tell us what it's like to be dead. What is the afterlife like? What is it like to be a ghost? Is there a God? At least, these would be my questions. Unfortunately, I am not a ghost, nor do I know anything about any afterlife. When I was alive, I did not believe in ghosts or heaven or God or spirit surviving the body or resurrection or reincarnation, and I still do not. If I had to describe my current state of existence, I would say that I am a cyst of memory. Dale's sense of me is so strong, so cut off and cauterized from the rest of his consciousness by trauma, that I seem to exist as something more than memory, something less than life, almost literally a black hole of holistic recollection formed by the collapsing gravity of grief. I know this does not explain it, but then I do not really understand it myself. I know only that I am, and that there was a quickening, might be the best word, when Dale decided to return and spend the winter at the farm where I once lived and where I died. And no, I have no memory of my death. I know no more of that event than does Dale. Evidently, one's death, like one's birth, is so important as to be beyond recall. When I was alive, I was only a boy, but I was fairly smart and totally dedicated to becoming a writer someday. I spent years preparing for that, apprenticing myself to the word, knowing that it would be many more years before I could write a real short story, much less a novel, but practicing with opening paragraphs for stories and novels nonetheless. If I were borrowing an opening for this tale, I would steal it from Thackeray's boring 1861 novel, Lovell the Widower. Who shall be the hero of this tale? Not I who write it. I am but the chorus of the play. I make remarks on the conduct of the characters. I narrate their simple story. Thackeray's omniscient eye was lying, of course. Any creator stating that he is a simple chorus and impassive observer of his creature's actions is a hypocrite and a liar. Of course, I believe that to be true of God, on the few occasions when I considered that he might exist at all. Once, when Dale and Mike and I were having a chicken house discussion of God, my only contribution was a paraphrased quote from Mark Twain. When we look around at the pain and injustice of the world, we must come to the ineluctable conclusion that God is a thug. I'm not sure if I believed that then or now, but it certainly shocked Mike and Dale into silence, especially Mike. He was an altar boy then and most devout. But I'm digressing, even before I begin the story. I always hated writers who did that. I still have no powerful opening line. I'll just begin again. 41 years after I died, my friend Dale returned to the farm where I was murdered. It was a very bad winter. Dale Stewart drove from western Montana to central Illinois, more than 1,700 miles, in 29 hours. The mountains dwindling and then disappearing in his rearview mirror, endless stretches of autumn prairie blending into a tan and russet blur. Following I-90 East to I-29 Southeast, to I-80 East to I-74 South and then east again, traveling through the better part of two time zones, returning to the checkerboard geometries of the Midwest, and forcing himself down through more than 40 years of memories like a diver going deep, fighting the pain and pressure that such depths bring. Dale stopped only for food, fuel, and a few catnaps at interstate rest areas. He had not slept well for months, even before his suicide attempt. Now he carried drugs for sleeping, but he did not choose to stop and use them on this trip. He wanted to get there as soon as possible. He did not really understand why he was going there. Dale had planned to arrive at Elm Haven in mid-morning, tour his old hometown, and then drive on to Duane's farmhouse in the daylight, but it was after 11 o'clock at night when he saw the Elm Haven exit sign on I-74. He had planned to move into Duane's old house in early or mid-September, allowing plenty of time to enjoy the fall colors and the crisp, sunny autumn days. He arrived on the last day of October, at night, in the last hours of the first Halloween of the new century, hard on the cold cusp of winter. "I screwed up," thought Dale, as he took the overpass above I-74 and followed the night-empty road the 2 miles north toward Elm Haven. "Screwed up again. Everything I haven't lost, I've screwed up. And everything I lost because I screwed it up." He shook his head at this, angry at the bumper sticker stupid self-pity of the sentiment, feeling the fog of too many nights with too little sleep, and punched a button to lower the driver's side window. The air was cold, the wind blowing hard from the northwest, and the chill helped to wake Dale a bit as he came out onto the hard road just a mile southeast of Elm Haven. The hard road, Dale smiled despite himself. He had not thought of the phrase for decades, but it immediately came to mind as he turned back northwest onto State Highway 150A and drove slowly into the sleeping town. He passed an asphalt road to his right and realized that they had paved County Road 6 between Jubilee College Road and the Hard Road sometime in the last few decades. It had been muddy ruts between walls of corn when he had lived here, so now he could drive straight north to Duane's farmhouse if he wished. He continued on into Elm Haven out of curiosity. Morbid curiosity, it turned out. The town itself seemed sad and shrunken in the dark. Wrong. Smaller. Dead. Desiccated. A corpse. The two business blocks of Main Street along the hard road had lost several buildings, disorienting Dale the way a familiar smile with missing teeth would. He remembered the tall facade of Jensen's Hardware. It was now an empty lot. The A&P, where Mike's mother had worked, was gone. He remembered the glowing windows of the Parkside Cafe. It was now a private residence. Lucky's Grill on the other side of the street appeared to be some kind of flea market with stuffed animals staring out at the hard road through dusty black eyes. The corner pantry market was boarded up. The barber shop next door was gone. Bandstand Park was worse than gone. The tiny yard-sized space was now cluttered with a tiny VFW hall and various tin sheds, the bandstand torn down, the trees uprooted and their stumps cut out, and the war memorial hidden by weeds. Dale made a U-turn and drove back east, turning north onto Broad Avenue. The clouds were low and the wind was cold. Leaves blew across the wide street ahead of his Toyota Land Cruiser, their dry scraping sounding like the scuttle of rats. For an instant, fatigue convinced Dale that these were rats, hundreds of them, rushing through the cones of his headlights. There were no streetlights on Broad Avenue. The great elms that used to arch over the wide street had fallen victim to Dutch elm disease decades ago, and the trees planted since seemed smaller, stunted, irregular, and ignoble in comparison. Some of the fine old homes along Broad still stood back behind their wide lawns, the houses dark and silent against the night wind. But like an old war veteran at a reunion, Dale was more aware of the missing houses than of the few survivors. He turned right onto Depot Street and drove the few blocks to his childhood home across the street from where Old Central School had stood. His home of 7 years was recognizable, but just barely. The huge old elm that had stood outside his and Lawrence's bedroom was gone, of course, and the new owners had long ago paved the short driveway and added a modern garage that did not go well with the American square design of the house. The front porch was missing its railings and swing. The old white clapboard had been replaced with vinyl siding. Jack-o'-lanterns and a bulging straw man in bib overalls had been set out on the porch in celebration of the holiday, but the candles had burned out hours earlier, leaving the jack-o'-lantern's triangular eyes as black and empty as skull sockets. The rising breeze had scattered the straw man's guts to the wind. Old Central, of course, was gone. Dale had few clear memories of the summer of 1960, but he remembered vividly the building burning, embers flying orange against a stormy sky. Now the once grand square city block was filled with a few ratty-looking ranch houses, dark and incongruous amidst the older, taller homes on each side of the square, and all signs of the former school building and its huge playground had long since been eradicated. The tall sentinel elms around the school block were gone, of course, and no trees had been planted in their place. The tiny houses on the square, all built after 1960, looked exposed and vulnerable under the black sky. There were more gaps in the rows of homes facing the former schoolyard. The Somerset place next to Dale's old home was just gone, not even its foundation remaining. Across the street from the Somersets, Mrs. Moon's tidy white home had been bulldozed into a gravel lot. His friend Kevin's family home, a ranch house that had seemed modern and out of place in 1960, was still there on its slight rise of ground, but even in the dark Dale could see that it was unpainted and in need of repair. Both of the grand Victorian homes north of Kevin's house were gone, replaced by a short dead-end street with a few new homes, very cheap, crowded where the woods had once started. Dale continued slowly east past Second Avenue, stopping where Depot Street ended at first. Michael Rourke's home still stood. The tiny gray shingled house looked just as it had in 1960, except for the rear addition that obviously had taken the place of the outhouse. The old chicken house where the bike patrol had met was gone, but the large vegetable garden remained. Out front, staring sadly across First Avenue at the harvested field, the Virgin Mary still held out her hands, palms outward, watching from the half-buried bathtub shrine in the front yard. Dale had seen no trick-or-treaters. All of the homes he had passed had been dark, except for the occasional porch light. Elm Haven had few streetlights in 1960 and now seemed to have none at all. He had noticed two small bonfires burning in yards along Broad, and now he saw the remains of another fire, untended, burned down to orange embers, sparks flying in the strong wind, in the O'Rourke side yard. He did not recall bonfires being lighted for Halloween when he was a boy here. Dale turned left, past the small high school and left Elm Haven behind, turning west on Jubilee College Road at the water tower and accelerating north on County 6, hurrying the last 3 miles separating him from Dwayne McBride's farmhouse. 2. I never left Illinois during my 11 years of life, but from what I've seen of Montana through Dale's eyes, it is an incredible place. The mountains and rivers are unlike anything in the Midwest. My Uncle Art and I used to enjoy fishing in the Spoon River not far from Elm Haven, but it hardly qualifies as river compared to the wide, fast, rippling rivers like the Bitterroot and the Flathead and the Missouri and the Yellowstone. And our lazy sitting on a bank and watching bobbers while we chatted hardly qualifies as fishing compared to the energetic fly-fishing mystique in Montana. I've never tried fly-fishing, of course, but I suspect that I would prefer our quiet, sit-in-the-shade, conversational, creekside approach to catching fish. I'm always suspicious of sports or recreational activities that begin to sound like religion when you hear their adherents preaching about them. Besides, I doubt if there are any catfish in those Montana rivers. Dale's corner office on the campus of the University of Montana, his former family home in the old section of Missoula, and his ranch near Flathead Lake are all alien to me, but fascinating. Missoula, for a city of only about 50,000 people, seems cordial to the things I probably would have loved had I lived to be an adult. Bookstores, bakeries, good restaurants, lots of live music, a very decent university, movie and live drama theaters, a vibrant downtown section. Dale's psychiatrist, a man named Charles Hall, had his office over one of these older used bookstores. Dale had been seeing Dr. Hall for the last 10 months before his trip back here. Dale had first visited the psychiatrist 2 days after he had set the muzzle of the loaded Savage over and under shotgun against his temple and pulled the trigger. Dr. Hall's office was small but comfortable. Books, artwork on the wall, a window looking out onto leaves, a desk off to one side, and 2 worn leather chairs facing each other with a small glass table between. The table held only a pitcher of ice water, 2 clean glasses, and a box of Kleenex. Dale had needed the Kleenex only on his 3rd visit, when he'd had a spring cold. During their last session in mid-October, the leaves had been red outside the windows, and Dr. Hall had been concerned about Dale's decision to spend the winter in Illinois. Eventually, however, the subject changed from emergency phone numbers and the necessity of Dale's getting in contact with another doctor to provide the necessary antidepressants and sleeping pills. "You understand that I strongly advise against your plan to spend the winter alone in Illinois," said Dr. Hall. "Noted," said Dale. "Does my advice make any difference?" "I'm spending $125 an hour for it," said Dale. "You're spending $125 an hour for therapy," said Hall, "to talk. Or in your case, Dale, not so much to talk, but to get the prescriptions you need. But you're still going to spend the next 10 months or so alone in Illinois."
"Yes," said Dale, "but only 9 months, the usual gestation period."
"You realize that this is a classic pattern?" Dale waited and listened. "A spouse dies, and the survivor moves away, especially men, Dale, and tries to start a new life, not realizing that what's needed at such a time is continuity, contact with friends, a support system."
"My spouse didn't die," said Dale. "Anne is alive and well. I just betrayed her and lost her and the girls."
"But the effect is the same."
"Not really," said Dale. "There's no continuity here. My home here in Missoula is off limits except for supervised visits and divorced daddy Sunday pickups. I hate that. And you agree that spending another winter at the ranch is a bad idea?"
"Yes, of course," said Dr. Hall.
"So I'm headed back to the Midwest to spend part of my sabbatical, back to the Jolly Corner."
"You never explained why your friend Duane called his home the Jolly Corner," said Dr. Hall. "Did he see it as a happy place? You said that the boy lived with just his father and that his father was an alcoholic. Was he being ironic? Is it possible that an 11-year-old would use such irony, or have you supplied that irony in the decades since then?"
Dale hesitated, not sure how to respond. He was embarrassed that Hall did not recognize the allusion to the Jolly Corner. If his psychiatrist didn't know Henry James, how smart could he be? Should he tell Hall that Duane hadn't told him about the Jolly Corner when he was 11? Duane had died at age 11, but had used that name for his farm when Dale had first moved to Elmhaven in 1956, when both boys were 8? An 8-year-old hick farm kid had known the Henry James story, and now Dale's $125 an hour shrink had never heard of it.
"I think Duane McBride is the only real genius I've ever met," Dale said at last. Dr. Hall sat back in his chair. Dale thought that for a psychiatrist, Hall did not have a very good poker face. He could see the skepticism in the doctor's slight rise of eyebrows and forced neutral expression.
"I know," continued Dale. "Genius is a powerful word. I don't use it often. Hell, I never use it. And I've met a lot of powerfully intelligent people in my lifetime, writers, academics, researchers. Duane is the only genius I've known."
Dr. Hall nodded. "But you knew him only as a child."
"Duane didn't live long enough to get out of childhood," said Dale, "but he sure was a strange kid."
"How so?"
Dr. Hall put his yellow notepad on his lap and clicked his ballpoint pen open, a habit that Dale found distracting and vaguely annoying. Dale sighed. How could he explain? You would have had to have met Duane, I think, to understand. On the outside, he was a big slob of a farm kid, fat, sloppy, lousy haircut. He wore the same flannel shirt and corduroy pants all the time, summer and winter. And remember, this was back in 1960. Kids actually dressed up for school in those days, even in little hick towns like Elm Haven, Illinois. Nothing fancy, but we had school clothes and play clothes and knew the difference. Not like the slobs in school today. Dr. Hall's supposedly neutral expression had shifted to the very slight frown that signaled that Dale had wandered from the subject. "Anyway," said Dale, "I met Duane shortly after my family moved to Elm Haven when I was in fourth grade, and right away I knew that Duane was different, almost scary. He was so smart."
"Scary?" said Dr. Hall, making a note. "How so?"
"Not really scary," said Dale, "but beyond our understanding." He took a breath. "All right, summer after fifth grade, the bunch of us boys used to hang around together in a sort of club we called the Bike Patrol, like a junior Justice League of America." Dale could tell that Hall had no idea what he was talking about. Perhaps male psychiatrists had never been boys. That would explain a lot. "Anyway, our clubhouse was in Michael Rourke's old chicken coop in town," continued Dale. "We had a sprung sofa in there, an old easy chair from the dump, the shell of a console radio, that kind of crap. I remember one night in the summer after fifth grade when we were bored and Duane started telling us the story of Beowulf, word for word, night after night, reciting Beowulf from memory. Years later, when I read the epic in college, I recognized it, word for word, from Duane's storytelling on those summer evenings."
Hall nodded. "That's unusual for someone that age to even know of Beowulf."
Dale had to smile. "The unusual part was that Duane told it to us in Old English." The psychiatrist blinked.
"Then how did you understand?"
"He'd rattle on in Old English for a while and then translate," said Dale. "That autumn he gave us a bunch of Chaucer. We thought Duane was weird, but we loved it."
Dr. Hall made a note.
"Once we were hanging around and Duane was reading a new book. I think it was something by Truman Capote, obviously a writer I'd never heard of at the time. And one of the guys, I think it was Kevin, asked him how the book was. And Duane said that it was okay, but that the author hadn't gotten his characters out of immigration yet." Dr. Hall hesitated and then made another note.
"Maybe you don't understand that," thought Dale, "but I'm a writer. Sometimes I'm a writer, and I've never had a goddamn editor make a remark that insightful. Any other manifestations of this genius?" asked the psychiatrist. Dale rubbed his eyes.
"That summer Duane died, 1960, a bunch of us were lying in a hammock out at Uncle Henry and Aunt Lena's farm just down the road from the Jolly Corner. It was night. We were looking at the stars, and Michael Rourke, he was an altar boy, said that he thought that the world all existed in the mind of God, and he wondered what it would be like to meet God, to shake hands with him. Without hesitating a second, Duane said that he'd worry about that because he suspected that God spent too much time picking his mental nose with his mental fingers." Dr. Hall made no note, but he did look at Dale almost reproachfully.
"Your friend Duane was an atheist, I take it?"
Dale shrugged. "More or less. No, wait. I remember Duane telling me one of the first times we hung out together. We were building a 3-stage rocket in fourth grade. He told me that he'd decided that all the churches and temples to the currently fashionable gods, that's what he called them, the currently fashionable gods, were too crowded, so he'd chosen some minor Egyptian deity as his god, learned the old prayer, studied the rituals, the whole nine yards. I remember him telling me that he'd considered worshipping Terminus, the Roman god of lawn boundaries, but had decided on this Egyptian god instead. He thought the Egyptian god had been ignored for many centuries and might be lonely."
"That is unusual," allowed Dr. Hall, making a final brief note.
Now Dale did have to grin. "If I remember correctly, Duane taught himself how to read Egyptian hieroglyphics just for that purpose, to pray to his forgotten little god. Of course, Duane spoke 8 or 9 languages by the time he died at age 11 and probably read a dozen more." Dr. Hall set aside his yellow legal pad, a sure sign that he was becoming bored with the topic being discussed. "Have you had any more dreams?" he asked. Dale agreed that it was time to change the subject. "I had that dream about the hands again last night."
"Tell me about it."
"It was no different than the previous ones."
"Yes, Dale, that's more or less the definition of recurring dreams, but it's interesting how one can find slight but important differences when the dreams are actually discussed."
"We haven't discussed dreams much."
"That's true. I'm a psychiatrist, but not, as you know, a psychoanalyst. But tell me about the hands dream anyway."
"It was the same as always. I'm a kid again."
"How old?"
10, 11, I don't know. But I'm in our old house in Elmhaven, sleeping in the upstairs room with my little brother Lawrence."
"Go on."
"Well, Lawrence and I are talking. There's a nightlight on, and Lawrence drops a comic book. He reaches down and, well, this hand comes out from under the bed and grabs him by the wrist, pulls him down."
"A pale hand, you said last time?"
"Yes. No, not just pale. White. Grub white. Dead white."
"What else about the hand? Or is it hands plural?"
"Just one hand at first. It grabs Lawrence by the wrist and pulls him off the bed before either one of us can react. The hand, the white hand, is weird. Long fingers. I mean, way too long. 8 or 9 inches long. Spider-like. Then I grab Lawrence by the legs."
"He has already been pulled under the bed at this point?"
"Just his head and shoulders. He's still screaming. That's when I see both of the spidery white hands pulling and cramming him under the bed."
"And sleeves? Cuffs? Bare arms?"
"No, just the white hands and blackness, but blackness darker than the dark under Lawrence's bed, like the sleeves of a black velvet robe, perhaps."
"And you don't succeed in saving your brother?"
"No, the hands pull him under and then he's gone."
"Gone?"
"Gone. As if a hole has opened up in the wooden floor and the hands had pulled him in."
"But your brother, in real life, is still alive and well."
"Yes, sure. He runs an insurance investigation agency in California."
"Have you discussed this dream with him?"
"No, we don't see each other that much. We talk occasionally on the phone."
"But you've never mentioned the dream?"
"No. Lawrence, well, he's a big, gruff guy sometimes, but he's also sensitive. He doesn't like talking about that summer, or about his childhood, actually. He had a rough time as a teenager in Chicago and had sort of a nervous breakdown after he dropped out of college."
"Do you think that he also has memory gaps about that summer of, when was it?"
1960.
"Do you think that he has the same gaps?"
"No. I don't know. I doubt it. He just doesn't like talking about it."
"All right. Back to the dream itself. How do you feel when you lose this tug of war and your younger brother disappears?"
"Scared, angry, and..."
"Go on."
"Relieved, I guess, that the hands had grabbed Lawrence instead of me, I think. Dr. Hall, what the hell does this mean?"
"We discussed the fact that dreams don't have to mean anything, Dale, but there almost certainly is a reason for having them. It sounds like a straightforward anxiety dream to me. Do you feel anxiety about the months ahead?"
"Sure I do, but why this dream?"
"Why do you think anxiety shows itself through this dream?"
"I have no idea." "It couldn't be a repressed memory."
"You think that you have an actual memory of white hands dragging your little brother under the bed?"
"Well, or something like that."
"We discussed repressed memories. Despite all the movies and TV talk about them, they are actually very, very rare, and a repressed memory would deal with a real event, such as physical or sexual abuse, not a fantasy nightmare. What is it? I can tell by your face that you're disturbed."
"Well, it wasn't the recurring nightmare that woke me up last night.
What was it?
A sound. A scrabbling noise under my bed. Is our time up?
Just about. I do have one final question.
Shoot, said Dale.
Why go all the way back to your childhood friend's house in Illinois to write this book? Why leave everything you know, everything you have in life, and go back to this empty house in a state you haven't lived in for 40 years?
Dale was silent for a full minute. Finally he said, I have to go back. Something's waiting for me there.
What, Dale?
I have no idea. To get to Dwayne McBride's farmhouse when he was a kid, Dale had pedaled his bike about a mile and a half west on the gravel of Jubilee College Road, turned north on County 6, an even narrower gravel road, past the Black Tree Tavern on his left, swooped down and up two steep hills past the Cavalry Cemetery where Elmhaven's Catholics were buried, and then straight on another half mile of flat road to the farm. Jubilee College Road had been paved and widened. The Black Tree Tavern was gone, as far as Dale could tell in the dark, the building torn down, a cheap mobile home tucked in under the trees where yellow bulbs on wires had once hung, and County 6 here had also been asphalted and widened. These two hills had been death traps when Dale had lived here, wide enough for only one car, slick with gravel, dark even on sunny days, with the overarching trees and the weeds coming right to the edge of the road, no shoulders for escape. It was exciting to pedal down and then coast up them on a bike, trying to keep on the hardened ruts of the road, and even the adults tended to play an elaborate game of chicken on the hills, accelerating their cars and pickup trucks down them in a cloud of dust and gravel and roaring to the top of the next hill with only the hope that no car was doing the same coming the other way. Frequently, the drivers were drunken farmers headed home from the Black Tree. Uncle Henry and Aunt Lena, who had lived in the neat little farmhouse just beyond the hills, had always joked that Cavalry Cemetery had been put where it was, on the top of the middle hill, just to save everyone the bother of dragging the victims of the car wrecks back to town. Now the asphalted road was easily wide enough for two cars to pass, and the woods and weeds had been cut back on either side. Dale pulled the Land Cruiser onto the grassy berm outside the Cavalry Cemetery, stopped the engine, left the headlights on, and stepped out into the night. The wind had come up more strongly now, and the low clouds seemed to be rushing by just yards overhead. There were no stars. The cemetery's tall, black iron gate and the long, spiked iron fence were visible in the headlights and looked just as he remembered them, except for the fact that they appeared to have grown black bat wings or witches' robes, long, flapping streamers of what seemed to be black crepe paper. It was no illusion. Dale could hear the frenzied flapping of the streamers and see different lengths of tattered black material waving and blowing eastward along the full length of the fence and all around the arched gate. Corn husks, thought Dale. Shucks, we used to call them. He had seen this post-harvest phenomenon when he was a kid here, and he often thought of it on windy days in Montana, when tumbleweeds lined the fences of the highways. To the east of the cemetery, across County 6, had been Old Man Johnson's farm when Dale was a boy, and whoever now owned the land still raised corn. Hundreds of these dried shucks and husks had blown from the field and tangled themselves on the black iron gate after the harvest. Harvested by a combine with rolling chain corn pickers, just like the machine that killed Dwayne. Had Dwayne's torn clothes and flesh flown through the night wind like this, catching and flapping on some barbed wire fence along this road? Dale shook his head. He was very tired. Dale had no family in the cemetery. His folks had not been Catholic. But he knew that the O'Rourkes and many of his other Elmhaven friends and acquaintances had people buried there. Some of those old friends of mine are probably buried there now as well, he thought. He would come back in the daylight and check. He would have plenty of time in the coming weeks. He climbed back into the Land Cruiser, started the engine, and headed down the next hill, leaving the flapping, waving, crackling apparitions behind. It was another mile to Dwayne McBride's farm. Dale passed his great-aunt Lena and Uncle Henry's farm to the right. The house was dark. And wondered who lived there now. Uncle Henry had died in 1970, but someone had told Dale that Aunt Lena was still alive in a home in Peoria, suffering from Alzheimer's, beyond communication for the last 2 decades or so, but still living. If the report was true, then the old woman had lived through parts of 3 centuries. Dale shook his head at the thought. What would it be like to outlive one's spouse by more than 30 years? He felt a lurch in his belly at the thought. He no longer had a spouse, and the idea still seemed strange to him. He almost missed the driveway to the McBride's farm. The place had always been marked by 2 things. Mr. McBride's refusal, because of his late wife's request, to grow corn that would conceal the farmhouse from the world, and vice versa in summer, and 1/4 mile of flowering crabapple trees that had lined the lane. Now the fields were stubbled with still-standing stalks of harvested corn, and most of the crabapple trees were gone. Dale knew just enough about farming to know that the remaining stalks meant that whoever was farming this land was using the plain tilling method. Dale drove slowly down the lane. When his headlights illuminated the dark farmhouse, his first thought was, Jesus, it's smaller than I remember. The place was dark, of course, without even the usual farmer's pole light illuminating the area between the house and the sheds and barn. There was a front door, but Duane and his father had never used it, so Dale pulled around the side of the house and looked at the side door. Sandy Whitaker, the real estate agent, had said that no one could find a key, but that it would not be locked, and that the power would be turned on by the time Dale arrived. He left the engine running to keep the headlights on the doorway as he trotted over. Both the screen and the inner doors were unlocked. Dale stepped into the kitchen. He raised his hand to his face and almost jumped back outside. The place smelled terrible, rotten, musty, decayed, worse. Something had died in there. He flicked the light switch. Nothing. The place was as dark as an unlighted cave, with only the slightest hint of light through the one kitchen window. Dale went back out to the truck, grabbed his halogen flashlight, and went back in. The kitchen looked as if it had been abandoned in mid-meal. There were plates on the counter and more in the sink. The stench grew stronger with each step he took, and Dale covered his mouth and nose with one hand as he crossed into the dining room. Jesus, the place is full of children's coffins. Dale froze in place, flicking the light in all directions. Instead of one dining room table, there were 6 or 8 rough benches set on sawhorses, and on each bench was a long, dull metal box the size and shape of a small coffin. Then he saw the slots for punch cards, rudimentary keyboards, and small windows on the metal boxes. Learning machines, Dale remembered. Duane's old man, always his friend's affectionate term for his father, had been an inventor. These were the pre-electronic learning machines that the old man had always been tinkering with, never completing to his satisfaction and rarely selling. Amazing, thought Dale. Duane's aunt, the old man's sister from Chicago, had lived in this place from 1961 right through to the eve of the millennium and had never moved all this junk. 40 years of living with these things in the dining room. The smell was stronger in here. Dale panned his flashlight around, found the light switch, and flipped it on. Nothing. Something had died in here, that was certain. Probably a mouse or rat. Possibly a larger animal. Dale had no intention of moving his stuff in or sleeping in here until he found the corpse, got rid of it, and aired the place out. He sighed, went back out to his Land Cruiser, shut it off, reclined the passenger seat as far as it would go, cracked all of the windows a bit, pulled an old blanket from the back seat, and tried to go to sleep. Dale was exhausted to the point that when he closed his eyes, he saw interstate highway center lines moving in headlights, overpasses flashing above him, exit signs flitting by. He was just dozing off when some fragment of dream or thought startled him awake. Dale reached over and pushed the button that locked all of the doors. 3. It was snowing when Dale awoke to dull morning light. Where the hell am I? It was an honest question. He was stiff, sore, still exhausted from the long drive, disoriented, cold, and achy. His head hurt, his eyes hurt, his back hurt. He felt as he usually did after the first hard day of a backpacking or horsepacking camping trip with its inevitable restless first night of fitful half-sleeping on the cold ground. Where am I? The snow was falling in discreet pellets, pounding and bouncing on the hood of the Land Cruiser. Not quite hail, not quite snow. Grapple was the word they used in the West. The windshield was iced up. The fields of harvested corn were glazed over. Duane's house, Illinois. That made no sense. Snow? It was the first day of November. Dale Stewart was used to snow in early autumn in Missoula, even more so at the ranch near Flathead Lake because of the elevation there, but in Illinois? He had lived in Elmhaven for 7 years of his childhood and could not remember snow before Thanksgiving in any of those years. Shit, he thought, rooting through his closest duffel bag for a jacket. Blame it on El Niño or La Niña. We've blamed everything else on them for the past 5 or 6 years. Dale stepped out of the Land Cruiser, tugged on his jacket, shivered, and looked at the house looming over him. As a writer, Dale had been forced to learn a little bit about basic house types and architecture. Writers have to learn a little bit about almost everything, was his opinion, and he recognized the McBride farmhouse as a national, pyramidal, family folk home. It sounded complicated, but all the term really meant was that it was one of about a million plain, equilaterally hipped roofed houses in the Midwest built around the time of the First World War. The McBride place was a two-story pyramidal, tall, with no side gables or interesting windows or details, flat all around, except for a tiny porch roof over the side door that Dale remembered the McBrides using almost exclusively. Most pyramidal family farmhouses had large front porches, but this front door boasted only a stoop and a bit of skimpy lawn. The side door opened onto the muddy turnaround area between the house and the outbuildings. Two tool sheds, a couple of small garage-sized general utility sheds, a chicken coop, and a huge barn where Mr. McBride had kept his farm equipment. Dale just hoped that the plumbing worked. He had to piss as bad as the proverbial racehorse. Plumbing? He thought. I don't need no stinking plumbing. He was at an abandoned farmhouse 3 miles from a dying little Illinois village. Dale glanced once down the long, dreary driveway toward the road, and then went around to the east side of the Land Cruiser to pee. The light snow was trying to turn to rain, but his urine melted a small circle on the frosted mud of the McBride's turnaround. A car horn bleated not far behind him. Dale zipped up quickly, guiltily, rubbed his hands against his slacks, and came around the Land Cruiser. A large, dark Buick had pulled up while he was peeing. The woman who got out was probably around Dale's age, but 50 pounds heavier, matronly, with frizzy hair dyed a totally false blonde. She was wearing a long, beige, quilted goose-down coat of the kind that had gone out of fashion about 15 years earlier.
"Mr. Stewart," said the woman. "Dale?"
For a second he was totally at a loss. Then the slow tumblers clicked into place. "Miss Whittaker." The heavy woman began walking carefully over the snow-covered ruts.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," she cried, coming too close to him. "Call me Sandy."
Dale had found the McBride house for rent on the Internet when he had contacted the local real estate company handling the house rental, a place out of Oak Hill. He had spoken to the woman for 10 minutes about the details of renting the vacant house before the two realized that they knew each other. She had said her name was Mrs. Sandra Blair, but only after he told her on the phone that he had lived in Elmhaven for a few years as a child did she say that actually she was divorced. She still kept the Blair name for business purposes because her ex-husband had been an important personage in Oak Hill and Peoria, but that her friends called her by her maiden name, Sandy Whittaker. Dale dimly remembered Sandy Whittaker as a thin, blonde, quiet girl who hung out with Donalou Perry, the best pitcher in their informal but daily summer baseball league. Now, as he stood looking at this heavy, hippy, jowled, top-heavy woman, all the time hoping that she had not seen him taking a leak as she drove up, he could make no connection at all with the 11-year-old girl from his past. Perhaps she had the same problem. He hadn't put on as much weight as she had, but his salt-and-pepper beard and glasses certainly hadn't been part of his image as a kid.
"Good heavens, Dale, we didn't expect you until tonight or tomorrow. The place has been cleaned up a bit and the electricity was to be turned on today. But when you called from Montana, we thought you said November 1st or 2nd.
"I did, Ashley," said Dale. "I just kept on driving. Shall we get out of the snow?"
"Yes, of course."
She was wearing high-heeled shoes. Dale could not remember the last time he had seen a pair of stiletto heels like these, especially on a woman so formidable. He held out his hand to help her across the frozen ruts and through the snowy patches.
"Very strange weather for so early in autumn," said Sandy Whittaker.
"That's what I thought," said Dale, as they came up onto the tiny side porch. "But then I thought maybe I'd forgotten what November was like here in Illinois."
"Oh, no, no. Usually very nice. It must be that terrible El Nino thing. Have you been in the house?"
"Only briefly last night," said Dale. "The power was out and... I should warn you, something died in there. A mouse or rat, perhaps. It smelled pretty bad." She paused at the doorway and arched one painted eyebrow. She was wearing so much makeup that it seemed to Dale that she was wearing a flesh-colored kabuki mask.
"Smell?"
she said.
"I was here yesterday with the cleaning lady and the propane people. There was no smell then. Do you think it's a gas leak?"
"No," said Dale, brushing the snow from his hair. "You'll see." He opened the door for her. Sandy Whittaker batted at the kitchen light switch, and the bare bulb came on. The dishes on the table and counter, Dale could now see, had been freshly washed and stacked. There was no smell whatsoever. "That's strange," he said. He stepped into the dining room where the cold daylight illuminated the gray boxes of the learning machines. There was no smell there either. "I was sure that something large had died in here." Sandy Whittaker giggled nervously.
"Oh, no, Mrs. Brubaker, that was Mr. McBride's sister, died in the hospital over at Oak Hill, where I live. Oak Hill, I mean, not in the hospital, that was almost a year ago, and Mr. McBride died in Chicago. Oh, when was it?"
1961, said Dale.
"Yes, of course, the winter after, well, after that terrible accident to little Duane out here."
Dale had to smile despite himself. His childhood friend had weighed over 200 pounds at age 11. No one had ever called him Little Duane.
"And he died in a farm machinery accident some distance from here, didn't he?"
continued the realtor. Dale realized that she was worried that he would think the house was haunted. "I just meant that last night it smelled as if a mouse or something died here," he said. "Whatever it is, it's gone."
"Yes,"
said Sandy Whittaker, all business now.
"Would you like to look at the house? I know that the snapshots I sent you via email weren't all that clear. I don't have one of those newfangled digital cameras. I just scan in the snaps from my little Instamatic."
"No, they were very helpful," said Dale. He glanced at his watch. "Aren't you working a little early? Oh, wait, I forgot that I lost an hour driving to the central time zone. My watch says 7:45. He started to reset it.
"No,"
said Sandy Whittaker, with a small frown, consulting her own watch.
"Your watch is right. It's just 7:45.
Dale paused. He was sure that he hadn't reset it during his drive. Then he realized the obvious. Daylight standard time had begun while he was traveling. Fall back, thought Dale. Indeed, he seemed to have fallen all the way back into his childhood hometown, his childhood friend's house, and this conversation with his elementary school classmate, without gaining or losing a minute of his life. Just 41 years, thought Dale with a slight tinge of vertigo bordering on nausea. Sandy led the tour, starting with the ample kitchen.
"I'm afraid only one burner works on the old stove. It's gas, of course. Everything runs off the propane tank out by the tool shed. I'm sure you can get some place in Oak Hill or Peoria to come fix it. The stove, I mean."
"I probably won't need more than one burner," said Dale. "Actually, it's a microwave I'll miss. I've been subsisting on hungry man frozen dinners. I guess now I'll just have to suck on them frozen." Sandy Whittaker actually stopped and stared at him in something like shock. He could see that she was revising her estimate of him down several notches.
I'm sure that there's an inexpensive microwave available in...
Dale held up his palms. I was just kidding. An old Woody Allen line, I think. The realtor frowned and nodded.
The refrigerator is small, but it still works. Plates and glasses and everything you'll need are in the cupboards here. Mrs. Brubaker was a very tidy person, but I had Alma, that's our cleaning person, wash everything again anyway. And the dining room here?
The floorboards creaked under Ms. Whittaker's weight. She paused to fiddle with the wall thermostat, and Dale heard an old furnace kick on seconds before the house filled with that not unpleasant, dusty smell of the first-time heat of autumn.
Well, she said, stepping further into the dining room, we just didn't know what to do with these machines. They were too heavy for Alma and me to carry all the way out to the old chicken coop or the barn, and of course the propane men were too busy to be bothered. I have no idea what these contraptions were, but obviously Mr. McBride had been working on them years and years ago. You may have noticed that Mrs. Brubaker kept everything as she found it, although cleaner, of course.
Why did she do that? Said Dale.
Do what?
Keep everything as she found it. Sandy Whittaker shrugged.
You remember how eccentric little Duane and his father were. Well, Mr. McBride's sister was the same way, I guess. She kept to herself. I don't think anyone ever visited except the Meals on Wheels people during her last year here. And Sarah, from Meals on Wheels, said that the house never changed. Mrs. Brubaker had kept it up like a museum.
What did she die of? Asked Dale.
Cancer,
said the realtor. The floorboards creaked again as she crossed the dining room, passed through a small arch with missing pocket doors, and stopped in the small, dark living room.
The living room, she said. I don't believe the McBrides ever spent much time in here, or Mr. McBride's sister, for that matter.
Two ancient chairs, a side table with a circa 1940s lamp, a sprung sofa, and a rug with huge white flowers grown gray over the decades. No radio, no television, no phone. The two tall windows here were so heavily draped that almost none of the weak morning light found its way in. Dale started to tug the drapes apart, found them pinned, undid the pin, and struggled to open them. Another layer of draperies was pinned inside the first.
You should have seen the dust before Alma and her daughter vacuumed, said Sandy.
I believe it, said Dale. This inner layer of dark drapes had actually been sewn together. Mrs. Brubaker must have been a vampire. He pulled a folding knife from his pocket, flicked open the gravity blade, and cut through the stitching. The drapes did not want to slide along the heavy rod, but eventually he wrestled them back. A once white curtain turned the sunlight a dim, watery yellow. He tugged the curtains down. I'm going to need more light in here to work, he explained, dropping the brittle curtains on the old couch and squinting up at the high draperies.
I don't think so,
said Sandy Whittaker. Dale folded his knife away and looked at her.
A vampire,
she said.
I don't think that Mrs. Brubaker was a vampire.
The tour of the rest of the first floor took only a few minutes. A National Pyramidal Family Folk Home was pretty much like Dale's former American Square home in Missoula before the additions had been added. Square, four rooms, a narrow hallway, and a bathroom. Going counterclockwise, the tiled kitchen, one window and a door, the large dining room, two windows with drapes and curtains, the small front living room, two heavily draped windows, the front entrance hall that ran back to the kitchen. Its front door had leaded glass, the only decorative item Dale noticed on the first floor, the front study across the hall from the living room, a small room but surprisingly cozy, with an old roll-top desk, built-in bookcases along the north wall, a single window looking down the front drive, and a long daybed with sleigh bed headboard and footboard.
This is where Mrs. Brubaker slept, and I believe Mr. McBride before that.
They didn't sleep upstairs, said Dale. Sandy Whittaker smiled. He was standing close enough to smell her talcum powder and perfume.
No. I believe I mentioned the reason in my first email to you.
They paused by the first floor bathroom. A pedestal sink, A wonderful clawfoot tub, but no shower. The black and white floor tile was chipped. The toilet actually had the flush box on the wall behind it, making Dale think of the scene in The First Godfather where Michael Corleone goes in the restroom of the Italian restaurant to find a pistol with which to kill Tattaglia and the police captain, played by Sterling Hayden. "No shower?" he said.
"There's one downstairs and one upstairs, I believe, but they never used the upstairs shower."
"Why not?" said Dale.
"I'll show you," said Sandy.
As it turned out, she did not accompany him upstairs. It was a narrow stairway, winding, enclosed in the wall between the bathroom and the front door. It had no light switch and was very dark. Dale was gallant, thinking of the steep, narrow stairway and Ms. Whittaker's size, and suggested that he go up alone, clumping up the steep, winding staircase in the dark. There was a dim light at the top. A thick spider web covered the door to the second-floor hallway. Something distorted and huge, a spidery shape as tall as Dale, moved in the layers of web, its limbs shifting and twitching, reaching for him. Dale simply froze. Later, he was glad that he did not scream. Certainly that story would have gotten around Oak Hill and Elm Haven. Dale Stewart, learned professor, rugged Westerner and author of the Jim Bridger Mountain Man series, scared by his own shadow. There were multiple layers of thick, clear construction plastic nailed across the doorway. The plastic had warped and yellowed with age. Dale remembered now that Dwayne McBride had said that his old man had shut off the second floor for heating reasons after Dale's mother had died. That must have been around 1952. Dale reached out and gingerly touched the first layer of plastic. Thick. Brittle. There must have been four or five layers nailed into place, each with its own latticework of folds and cracks. Dim light from a second-story window barely made it through the discolored layers. No wonder he had thought it was a web. The giant spider, of course, had been his own distorted reflection. He leaned closer but could still see no detail of the hallway or rooms beyond. Dale clicked open his knife, set the blade to the plastic, and then thought better of it. He went carefully down the steep stairway.
"Is it still all sealed off?" asked Sandy Whittaker.
"That's an understatement," said Dale. "I was going to cut through the plastic, but I figured I'd better ask you if there was some reason for the second floor being off-limits, Ebola virus or something."
"Pardon me?"
said Sandy Whittaker. "Just kidding. I'm just curious as to why all the plastic sheeting."
"Don't you remember in the email I sent you?"
said Sandy.
"I mentioned that Mrs. Brubaker had never heated the second floor, that it was shut off."
"I thought you meant the heating vents," said Dale with a soft smile. They had walked back into the kitchen where there was more light. "I didn't know you meant that Mr. McBride had hermetically sealed the whole second floor."
"Alma wouldn't go up there," said Sandy.
"Why?" said Dale. "Is it haunted? Is Mr. McBride's crazy second wife sealed in up there or something?" Mrs. Whittaker could only stare. Her lipsticked mouth hung slightly open. "Just kidding again," Dale said hastily, making a mental note not to joke with Sandy Whittaker again. Had she been this literal as a kid? He could not remember. He had not hung around the girls much. "Now I remember when I lived here as a kid," said Dale. "Dwayne saying something about their second story being shut off because of the heating bills." Sandy Whittaker finally managed a nod.
"I assure you, Dale, Mr. Stewart."
"Dale," said Dale.
"I assure you, Dale, that as far as I know, that's absolutely the only reason for the second floor to be sealed off. The old coal furnace was converted to propane in the 1950s and was never as efficient afterward. Mrs. Brubaker slept in the study. I think Mr. McBride had slept there as well after his wife died, and, well, no one needed the second floor."
"I just made the joke because you said Alma, the housekeeper, right? Alma wouldn't go up there," Dale said lamely.
"Alma is 74 years old," said Sandy, "with a bad hip. It's the staircase she's afraid of. Now, you've rented the entire house, Dale. If you would like the upstairs to be opened up, I'll get my nephew over here to take the plastic down, and then Alma, or Alma's daughter, will help me clean and air out the rooms. I imagine that the air up there could be a little stale if it's been shut off for almost 50 years.
Dale held his palms up. He had almost made a joke about unsealing Tutankhamun's tomb, but stopped himself in time. "I don't need the second floor," he said. "If I do, I'll tell you. And for $175 a month, the first floor and that nice study should work for me."
"If you think the rent is too high," began Sandy.
Dale had to sigh and shake his head. "Even in Missoula, you couldn't rent a decent room for that amount, Sandy. Everything's fine. Did you say that there's a shower in the basement?"
4. There was more than a shower in the basement. Dale had forgotten that Duane had more or less lived in the basement of this farmhouse. When Dale had been a boy in Elmhaven, he had been terrified of his own basement. It had been a labyrinth of small rooms with the coal bin far in the back of the maze, and he'd been frightened every night when he had to go down and shovel coal into the hopper. The McBride basement could not have been more different. Essentially, it was one large room, the huge furnace taking up much of the south end, but clean, tidied up, with workbenches along one wall, an old washing machine with wooden rollers, coils of clothesline, a huge jerry-rigged shower tapping into the plumbing under the first-floor bathroom, an old-fashioned but complete darkroom set up near the water pipes, and Duane's corner. Dale remembered that he had been in Duane's home only once, breaking in through one of the 6 narrow windows set high up on the cement walls here after Duane had died. He had come for Duane's private notebooks, and he still had them, wrapped and secure out in the Land Cruiser, 13 thick spiral notebooks filled with Duane's small, almost illegible, shorthand script. Duane's room was still there, a corner of the basement partitioned off by a quilt hanging on a clothesline. The quilt smelled freshly laundered to Dale as he stood next to it, and by various crates piled high and filled with paperbacks. Dale slid back the quilt. Duane McBride had assembled an old brass bed down here, and the thick mattress looked more comfortable than the smaller day bed in the parlor upstairs. All around the bed were more bookcase crates, filled with paperbacks and old hardcover books, and on top of most of the crates were radios, clunky 1960 transistor radios, complicated receivers obviously made from kits, simple crystal sets, several Bakelite 1950s models, and even a huge Philco floor radio against the wall near the foot of the bed. At a small desk between the bed and the Philco sat a real shortwave radio, able to send as well as receive, with antenna wires running up and out the narrow window. "I forgot that Duane had been a ham radio operator," Dale said softly, almost whispering.
"We don't know if it still works," whispered Sandy Whittaker, "but Mrs. Brubaker kept everything clean down here as well."
"I'll say she did," said Dale. "This basement is cleaner than my ranch in Montana." Sandy Whittaker did not know what to say to that, so she pursed her lips and nodded. "Seriously," said Dale, gesturing around the large basement, "there's more light here than upstairs." Besides the 6 uncovered basement windows, working almost like clearstory windows set high on the wall, there were 4 hanging light bulbs illuminating the open space and 2 small lamps that still worked next to Duane's old bed. The place was actually cozy. Sandy Whittaker glanced at her watch.
"Well, I just wanted to make sure that everything was ready for you. I'd better get back to the office."
They paused in the kitchen. The snow had stopped, but it was still cloudy and cold outside. "I wish I had something to offer you," said Dale. "Maybe a glass of water?" Sandy Whittaker frowned at the tap.
"We think the water is all right. It's well water, not city water, but you might consider bringing in bottled water to be safe."
Dale nodded, smiling again. He had not heard the phrase city water for more than 4 decades. All of the implications came back to him now. Elmhaven's tap water had been sulfurous, gritty, nasty, undrinkable. Even people in town had used backyard wells. The realtor was handing him several pieces of paper, a receipt for the checks he had mailed her for damage deposit and first and last month's rent. He planned to stay 9 months. A list of emergency phone numbers, most of them in Oak Hill, he noticed. Her number, the addresses of a medical clinic in Oak Hill, a dentist, and various stores. "I need to do some grocery shopping before nightfall," said Dale. "I noticed that the A&P and Corner Pantry were gone. Where do people in Elmhaven shop these days?" Sandy made a gesture, and Dale noticed how dainty her wrists and hands were, even with such plump arms.
"Oh, most people drive to the old Oak Hill grocery store a block from the park, or into the West Side Peoria Safeway. or if they're in a hurry, out to the quick and easy.
She spelled it for him.
It's that travel convenience store built onto the Shell station out at the I-74 interchange,
she explained.
Bread, milk, that sort of thing. Prices are ridiculous, but it's easy to get to.
Quick and easy, repeated Dale. He hated chain stores and convenience stores only slightly less than he hated TV evangelists and World War II-era Nazi war criminals. Dale accompanied Sandy Whitaker out to her huge black Buick. The woman paused by the car.
Do you hear from any of your old friends from the old days, Dale?
Elmhaven pals, you mean? Said Dale. No. I wrote letters for a while after we moved back to Chicago in 1961, but I haven't heard from any of the old gang for years. Any of them still live here? The realtor thought for a second.
Not that group you were with. Mike O'Rourke, Kevin Grumbacker, those boys, right?
And Jim Harlan, said Dale with a smile.
Oh, well, maybe you know that Jim Harlan became a U.S. Senator from Illinois.
Dale nodded. Harlan had been in the Senate 20 years before a sex scandal had ruined his chances for re-election in 2000.
The O'Rourkes, the parents, still live in the same house,
said Sandy.
My God,
said Dale, they must be 100 years old.
In their 80s,
said Sandy.
I haven't spoken to them for years. I understand that Michael was hurt real bad in Vietnam and then became a priest.
That's what I heard as well, said Dale. But I can't find any trace of him on the internet.
And Kevin Grumbacker,
continued Sandy, not listening to him.
His parents died, you know. The last I heard, he was working for NASA or some such.
Morton Theocole, said Dale. He noticed the lack of comprehension in her eyes. That's the company that builds the solid rocket boosters for the space shuttle. I found some old articles. Evidently, Kevin was working for them during the Challenger disaster in 1986 and blew the whistle on them. Testified about the fact that the company knew about the faulty O-rings. Sandy Whitaker still stared blankly at him. Dale shrugged. Anyway, he resigned in protest in 86, and I couldn't find any other articles or listings about him. I think he lives in Texas. He felt uncomfortable talking about his old friends with this woman, even though he was curious about what she knew. To change the subject, he said, What about your old school friends from Elmhaven? Still in touch with Donna Lou Perry?
She's dead,
said Sandy.
Murdered.
Dale could only blink.
A long time ago,
she said.
Donna Lou married Paulie Fussner in, I think it was 1970, and she tried to get a divorce in 74, I think it was. He tracked her down and beat her up. She went back home to live with her folks in Elmhaven, but he waited for her one morning and shot her.
That's terrible, said Dale. Donna Lou was the one female from his childhood here whom he'd hoped to run across to apologize for something that had happened on the baseball diamond 42 years earlier. Now he never could. Jesus, he said. Sandy nodded.
It's been a long time. The new century makes me feel like we're all ancient, talking about people and things from the middle of the last century and all. Who else was in that group of yours?
Cordy Cook, said Dale, still thinking about the murdered Donna Lou.
Don't know what happened to her.
Dale did. He had found out through the net that the moon-faced little white trash Cordy Cook had become a millionaire 100 times over, had sold the largest waste management company in America a few years ago, and was currently running an expensive rehabilitation center for cancer victims on the Big Island of Hawaii. He didn't take time to share all this with the realtor.
There was some other boy in your bunch,
said Sandy. Dale thought for a moment. My kid brother Lawrence?
No, someone else.
Dwayne McBride, he said. Sandy Whitaker actually blushed.
Yes. I guess that's who I was thinking of.
She got in the car and started the engine. Dale stepped back, preparing to wave goodbye, but Sandy rolled the window down.
Oh, I meant to tell you, Dale. My cousin's boy, Derek. When he heard you were renting the place, he said he knew all about you.
Oh, Christ, thought Dale. A Jim Bridger Mountain Man fan.
Derek's sort of a problem child, I guess you could say. Though he's 19 now, so not really a child. Anyway, my cousin Ardith says that Derek knew your name from his internet friends, that they'd sent your photograph and articles out to all the others.
Articles? Said Dale. Do you mean novels?
No, the articles that were in some Montana newspaper.
Ah, Christ, Dale said aloud. Do you mean the editorials on the Montana militia? At the height, or depths, to be more accurate, of his clinical depression a year earlier, he had written a series of editorials about the right-wing militias. I thought those were only being routed around to other neo-Nazi groups and skinheads. Sandy bit on her lower lip.
I don't think Derek is a whatchamacallit Nazi, but he does hang around with skinheads. Heck, he is a skinhead. Anyway, I wanted to tell you, you don't want to get on the wrong side of Derek and his friends.
Sounds like I already have, said Dale. He folded his arms. Great beginning to my sabbatical. It was starting to rain again.
Call me if you need anything,
said Sandy Whittaker. She rolled up the window, ponderously turned the huge Buick around in the muddy lot, and drove down the long driveway in the rain. In the dim daylight, the dead crabapple trees looked even sadder and more skeletal. Dale shook his head, went over to the Land Cruiser, and started hauling his boxes of junk, his life, into the McBride farmhouse.